Good morning. Please turn with me to 1 Samuel and chapter 8. And while you're turning there, I'll mention a couple of books that you might find useful. One especially is a book, Understanding the Land of the Bible, by O. Palmer Robertson. Robertson wrote Christ of the Covenants, which is probably the best modern treatment of covenant theology in a systematic way. And this book is a biblical theological guide. It's a treatment of the land of Palestine, but he weaves in some of the history and the significance in terms of God's work in redemptive history. It's a very good book. His writing is not the liveliest, but it's still very helpful, and so I recommend it to you. It's published by Presbyterian Reform P&R Publishing. One book I'm going to quote from today, I wouldn't necessarily recommend so highly, although it is an interesting book. This is Great Battles of Biblical History by General Sir Richard Gale. This is a man who served actually in Palestine for the British under the UN mandate in the mid-40s. And he goes through different events of biblical history, actually some in the intertestamental period with the Maccabees, and talks about the significance from a military point of view. And I'm going to quote from part of it, but it's an interesting. He has generally appreciative view of the Bible, and you know, he refers to divine providence, but his point of view is clearly historian, and I'm not sure his view of the Bible would be called evangelical necessarily. But there are some interesting things he says that I thought I would refer to at some point today. Okay, and First Samuel, last week we got as far as finishing chapter 7, roughly, and that is we looked at the life of Samuel from the beginning until the time when he was established as both as a judge and in many ways functioning as a priest and certainly clearly as a prophet. And in chapter 8, we come to the time when the people are unhappy with the rule that God has set up for them, and they ask for a king. So let me read just the first part of 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." And he goes on to rehearse the idolatry which they have followed for quite a while, and he commands Samuel to heed their voice. Now, this is, in a sense, a transition from what we looked at last week with Samuel to what we'll look at this week with Saul and David. Here the people are asking for a king, and of course, as we emphasized in the book of Judges, God was their king. He had set up a system of judges who would deliver them when they cried out to the Lord after a period of falling away from God. And it's said in verse 7 pretty clearly that this is a rejection of God as king, and that's repeated, that idea is repeated in the subsequent chapters. Now, you can see in it, part of their motivation is a desire to be like all the nations. And that's repeated again later on. And it's interesting to look at that and compare. What is that? It's just a horse fly. It's a big horse fly. Is to compare the king they desired so they could be like the nations with Saul and how he was like the king of all the other nations ultimately. They got what they asked for, and well, we'll see about that. What they failed to see was that the reason this, if you like, the system didn't work. I mean, they saw Samuel's sons failing, and we talked about that, the failure of his own leadership just a bit before. they failed to see that the problem wasn't in God, but in the trusting to human leaders and in their own rebellion against God. And that, again, that theme will work its way out. This doesn't solve the problem of their unhappiness with God as a ruler. It just changes the shape of it. Now, there's an interesting passage in the last part of 1 Samuel 8, which is interesting to read from our perspective, having been, you know, developed in political history this long since then. Samuel tells them all the things that a king will do to them, and, you know, he talks about this excessive 10% tax rate and things like that. So it would be tempting to go, you know, to take a lot of time to discuss it, but he does point out in verses 11 and following the sort of behavior that the king will have, the way the king will act. And he says in verse 11, he will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captain over his fifties. He will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And it goes on and about the thing that the king will do. And he says at the end of this, in verse 18, you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. So God is hearing them in this day and answering their request, but he is warning them that they will understand at the end what it is that they have brought on themselves and cry out to the Lord. It doesn't change their minds in verse 19. No, we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations. Pattern, of course, is Samuel is not saying this is the way the king should act. I don't know if I need to make that clear. There were clear regulations in the book of Deuteronomy for the way the king was supposed to act. There were limitations on his power, and we talked about those quite a while ago. It's not that it was bad to have a king, as I think I made the point last week, but the way they asked for the king is certainly wrong. God had promised, and there were prophecies, that he would send a ruler, and this is in the line of the Messiah, ultimately, that there would be this king. But their attitude is wrong, and it brings disaster for them. Now, let me just fill out that before we turn to look at Saul, just a little bit more in chapter 12. So if you flip over to chapter 12, come back to the intervening chapters, but just to carry forward the idea, in between, Saul has been anointed as king. And there is a speech by Samuel in chapter 12. It's his farewell speech. Now, Samuel doesn't move off the scene completely. He still functions as a prophet, but he no longer functions as a judge because they have a king. And that's really the purpose of his saying in verses 1 and following. He says, indeed, I have heeded your voice and all that you said to me and have made a king for you over you. And now here is the king walking before you, and I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I've walked before you from my childhood to this day. At first, he testifies to his own integrity as a ruler, you know, whose ox have I taken, and so on. That will be a contrast with the king that they had called for themselves. But interestingly enough, through the chapter, the rest of the chapter, it has the same structure as we talked about in the book of Deuteronomy of these ancient covenants. He rehearses for them what God has done for them. For example, in verse 6, it is the Lord who raised up Moses and Aaron. He talks about God's works for them, and he warns them not to rebel. He goes through the history, actually, in a fair amount of detail, and warns them again in verse 12 that their desire for a king was in rejection of God being their king. And he calls them to obedience. In verse 14, if you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. However, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord, which is what happens, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. And so it goes from there to describe the judgment that will come on them and calls them then to faithfulness in following after God. The last part we looked at before, where Samuel promises to be a faithful intercessor for them still, beautiful statement, verse 23, "Far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way." Now that's then the context in which Saul is set up as king. It is in the context of the wrong motive of the people and the warning of Samuel of the sort of king they will have. Now let's turn back then and think a little bit of the story of Saul. The story proper picks up in chapter 9, which is what I just skipped over when I went from 8 to 12. And in chapter 9, you find a man, Saul, who is of Benjamin, a small and relatively insignificant tribe. And he is anointed first in private. So there's a description of that. It's an interesting description. Saul is out looking for the donkeys, and somehow, you know, Samuel comes to him and he's anointed as king. And then there's a second a confirmation of that in the last part of chapter 10, where he is publicly selected to be the king. And you may remember the description of that. It starts in verse 21 of chapter 10. "He had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families. The family of Machri was chosen," and so on and so on. It's singled out down to Saul, who is hidden among the equipment. I think the King James is baggage. Okay, so the guy is hidden away. Okay, and then that's confirmed. His leadership is then confirmed in chapter 11, where he leads the people to victory. The Ammonites have been threatening, and Saul leads them to victory in chapter 11. And in that sense, is confirmed as a king. So you can see in the response of the people toward the end of chapter 11 to the leadership of Saul. Now, it's a striking thing to look at Saul at the very beginning. He doesn't look like a bad choice at all. Saul is a humble one. He apparently is not seeking power. When Samuel comes to him, he says, you know, "Who am I, and who is my tribe?" And he's hiding among the equipment, even after the public selection. He isn't one who seeks vengeance for himself. There are people who questioned his leadership at the end of chapter 10, but after the victory in chapter 11, you know, the supporters said, "Well, let's deal with these people who didn't want you as king." And Saul says, "I'm not going to have any of that." So at the beginning, Saul looks like a good choice. He looks like the sort of man who would be a king after God's own heart. But there's a series in the next chapters, 13, 14, and 15, a series of sins committed by Saul, which makes it clear from the word that Samuel brings that he is not to be the ultimate king. And I'm going to go over those just quickly. I didn't put my goal up here, but I'm thinking maybe I could get to chapter 26, and you all can laugh if you want. But I want to go just quickly through Saul's life and look at some of the events, and then we'll, as far as we can get, and David, well, we'll see. In chapter 13, the first of the major sins is described of Saul, and that is his offering the sacrifice against the schedule that had been given to him. Now, the context is that of a battle, and in battle with the Philistines. And Samuel had told him to wait for him to come. But you notice in verse 8 the impatience of Saul. And I'm reading 1 Samuel 13 and verse 8. "Then he," that's Saul, "waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him." Now, I may not have set the context very clearly, but they're gathered for battle. And you don't just have these warriors sitting around waiting for very long. They have to act. At least so it would seem to Saul. So Saul says in verse 9, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came. And Saul went out to greet him, to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. Now, we should pause here and maybe even try to put this in our modern American context. This is a pretty compelling argument for what he did. I mean, it's a pragmatic argument, but it sounds pretty compelling because he was facing a battle. Samuel had not arrived in time. And he was certainly seeking after God. After all, what he was doing was offering a sacrifice. It's not necessarily the case that he offered the sacrifice himself, which would have been a severe abuse of power on the part of the king. Even if it's not that, even if he, you know, arranged for the priest to do it, it's not what Samuel had said to do. And yet it has its own plausibility about it, doesn't it? He wanted to offer sacrifice before they went into battle. They wanted to seek the Lord. It sounds like a good argument, and it may therefore be jarring to our ears to hear Samuel say in verse 13, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Now, this the specific judgment is probably not a removal of Saul from the kingship at this point. I think the force of it, and the commentaries seem to support this, the force of it is not that he is no longer king, but that he will not have a dynasty or a succession. Your kingdom shall not continue. That would not pass to a successor. Certainly, it's not long before it's said that you are removed from the kingship, and David is anointed even while Saul is still functioning as king. But this judgment, which, as I said, may seem a little out of place. Here is a pragmatic but yet sincere man who is seeking God, and he is judged rather severely, perhaps from our point of view, for what he has done. So I'm going to hold on to that thought a little bit as we look at chapter 15, which is kind of a complementary treatment, and there's a statement by Saul, by Samuel, rather, that also applies in this case. In between, though, is another sin of Saul in chapter 14. And this sin has to do with a foolish oath. He is in, again, a challenge with the Philistines, and it's the oath itself is given in verse 24, where Saul says, he placed the people under oath, saying, cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I've taken vengeance on my enemies. Now, think about this. This guy is leading an army, and he's saying they're not supposed to eat any food all day until they've taken vengeance on their enemies. It doesn't sound like a very wise sort of thing to do. But in fact, it's not just that. It actually comes back upon his own son, and he insists that it be carried out on his son. The description of the way it came on Jonathan is an interesting one. And so I'm going to step aside from Saul just a second to look at the statement of Jonathan. Jonathan, of course, is the son of Saul. And in verse 1 of chapter 14, this is really the context for the oath that that Saul gives. It says in chapter 14, verse 1, now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he did not tell his father. Now, they're in the situation where the enemies have the weapons and the Israelites don't. I didn't read this part, but at the end of chapter 13, starting at verse 19, it says there was no blacksmith to be found in all the land of Israel. Okay. We talked about the gap in technology earlier, that in the time of the judges, their opponents had the iron chariots and knew how to use iron. They didn't. It's a similar situation here. It's not a good situation to be in. Saul and his sons do have the equipment, and so Samuel, I got too many names mixed up here, Jonathan, the son of Saul, takes his shield bearer with him and goes over. And there's a description in the verses that follow what I read of what the geographic situation is. And this is I'm going to read a quotation from this Battles of the Bible book I referred to earlier. In verse 4, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozaz, and the name of the other, Sinna. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving, by many or by few. Which is a beautiful and noteworthy statement, a statement of a man of faith who believes that God can accomplish great things. So his armor bearer said to him, Do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you, according to your heart. And that's also a statement of faith, because the armor bearer was putting himself in trouble. And then, in the way of harm. Then Jonathan said, Very well, let us cross over to these men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, Wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, Come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. And the rest of the story, the men of the Philistine garrison do see them and say, Come up, and God does deliver them into his hand. And that's really the initiation then of the battle that Saul is referring to in the verse I read at the end, read earlier in verse 24, when he forbids people from his army from eating. Now, I thought I would read this book that I mentioned, this Great Battles from the Bible, Heat of the Bible. Gail, as I said, had been stationed in Palestine after World War II under the UN mandate. And he describes the geographic situation as well as the military slant on different of these things. He talks about the element of surprise as being important, and he gives a lot of historical examples, including Stonewall Jackson, for those of you who are interested in things like that. But he says these raids had something in common with that of Jonathan. They struck right deep into the enemy camp and were carried out by a handful of men against vastly superior numbers. The usefulness of such actions is dubious unless they form part of a larger plan, and this is precisely what Jonathan's exploit did. And then he gives probably the most interesting example of all, which is during World War I, Lord Allenby, who was the leader of the British forces in Palestine, so Lawrence of Arabia, was affiliated with Allenby, although I guess he worked more directly with the Arabs. And it turns out that Allenby, based on this account in 1 Samuel 14, was able to win a significant victory. So he describes it this way. Finally, and probably most interesting of all, in Allenby's campaign in Palestine in the First World War, one of his brigades used this very same stratagem, which was inspired by the story as told in the Bible. Patrols were sent out to find if this route, the one they were just reading about, did in fact exist. And they found a gap as described between the two great rocks. On this, the plan was altered, and instead of mounting a brigade attack, one company only moved up in the dark. And reaching the small flat plateau where Jonathan stood facing the Philistines, they found and surprised the Turkish garrison, which in disorder took to its heels. So that was an interesting fact. One of the advantages of knowing the Bible, I guess, if you're fighting in that part of the world. Okay, the third, back to Saul. That was a little bit of an aside. But the third major sin of Saul that's described here is in chapter 15. And really, chapters 13 and 15, as I said, go together and earn this more severe rebuke than what I talked about in chapter 14. And that is the commandment to annihilate the Amalekites. Now, I put up two references here. This seems perhaps a little bit strange. It says in verse 2, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came back up from Egypt." And the command is to utterly destroy. That is, they were to take no booty, nothing at all. They were to wipe out everything. And the point of that is that this is a judgment of God. This is not merely a regular battle where they could take the spoils of war. This is God's judgment. The passage of that's referred to in verse 2 is in Exodus 17. And in Deuteronomy 25, the Lord confirms that Amalek is to be destroyed. Saul has a better idea. Okay, so in the verses that follow, it's described, the actions of Saul are described. And in particular, he takes the king alive in verse 8, Agag, king of the Amalekites. And in verse 9, Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, and the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But clearly, this is not what God had commanded them to do. But the Lord then, in response, sends Samuel in verse 10. And Samuel confronts Saul. This is the classic sinner's response to confrontation. Verse 13, Samuel goes to Saul, and Saul says to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord." Well, I guess, sort of. But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" And Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." So he shifts the blame, but that's not really the end of his own defense. Samuel goes on to say what the judgment of God will be. And he asks in verse 19, "Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me, on which the Lord sent me, and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took up the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." And that's then confirmed by the passage that follows, where the robe, Saul seizes the edge of Samuel's robe and tears it, and that's used by Samuel as a prophetic description of what will happen, that the kingdom is torn from him and given to someone else. Now, this description of the sin of Saul in verses 22 and 23, again, is something that may surprise us. It did look like Saul had a good motivation to serve God, and he certainly had a zeal to the worship of God, at least if you construe his actions in the best possible way. He didn't save all of these things for his own good, but to sacrifice to the Lord. And yet God will have none of that sort of justification. This is a good reminder that zeal in worship by itself is not a sufficient justification. This is the continual strain of the prophets, that God desires obedience to his voice, and to put in place of it something good, even following after the sacrificial system, is as idolatry. It's pretty strong language, isn't it? But this is why the second commandment in forbidding a certain kind of idolatry, that is the worshiping of God by graven images, is so closely connected with the first commandment, which is the worshiping of other gods. And it is this attitude of putting our own will in place of God's will in his service that God condemns here as idolatry, and as rejection of God's word. So Saul is rejected as king. We should not, I think, pass by too lightly the fact that all of this was a great grief to Samuel. It says in verse 11, it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. And that's in the context of the word from God saying that Saul was rejected as king. And that, I'm not going to look at the various references to that, but it comes up at the end of chapter 15. At the beginning of chapter 16, the Lord says, how long will you mourn for Saul? The fact that this happened according to the will of God and the prophecy of God doesn't mean that Samuel should not be grieved over what happened. He realized how great the sin was and how the judgment of God was going to fall on Saul, and he was grieved because of it. Maybe one other point that could be made is that it says in verse 11 that God says, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king. And this is an example of how one can take out of context statements and come up with bizarre views of God's openness. That's the current term in which people say that God doesn't actually know the future. He doesn't determine the future, nor does he know it. After all, if he regrets that he had set up Saul as king, that means he didn't know what was going to happen, right? Well, this is a good example of misusing a verse in its context, because at the end of this passage, in verse 29, it says very clearly, the strength of Israel will not lie nor relent. He is not a man that he should relent. You always have to interpret verses in their larger context. The fact that God regretted this should not be understood as a lack of foresight on God's part, but rather it is an example of the failure of Saul to fulfill the purpose that God had put for him. And God would not turn back from his judgment. He is not a man that he should lie or relent. The remaining portion of the book weaves together Saul's life and David's life. And the general description is Saul goes downhill, and he goes downhill fast. He acts like a madman. And at the end, of course, he dies in battle at the very conclusion of the book. We may come back to that next week, but what I want to do now is turn to the life of David, the man, the king after God's own heart, and see how God works in him. But let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions so far what we've talked about. Right. I think the time period is given at the beginning of chapter 13 describes Saul as having reigned 2 years over Israel, and then these things happen. So is that the starting point of the mature?
Yeah, I was thinking that Samuel was already old.
Right.
Trying to ascertain more how Samuel was trying to solve the case.
Oh, I see. Yeah, David actually comes to the throne at the age of 30. So, and he was first anointed in his late teens or around 20. But Samuel died somewhere in between those two, right? So it's a little hard to say. He was pretty old already when Saul ascended to the throne. But he didn't live that much longer.
Also interesting to look at the response of one chastising.
Right.
In
yeah.
The life of Saul. You see the beginning in chapter 13 where he's more or less had this initial judgment regarding the lie and the kingdom. And basically, Samuel arose and went up to Gilgal, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him. That was Saul's response.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me figure out what happened. And then after this discourse, you don't really see Saul with a genuine. language is very careful in what he says, and although you can make an argument with you that that all makes sense on the surface,
right?
That's God never deals that way, and just like you had said, and it's worth looking into, but it's a downward spiral. His response to God is continued, increasingly more adversarial. You know, it's a striking.
It is. And of course, by the end of the book, he's seeking for a medium. You know, he can't get a word from God, but he'll try anything. And it's he simply just refuses to turn to God in repentance.
You see glimpses of hope in his interactions with David as David spares him.
Right.
And you see his awareness that God is doing something outside of him. And
yeah.
There's not a turning to take. There's no internalization happening. It's pretty sad. It's one of the saddest descriptions of the downfall.
It is.
It'd be better if his head had been lost off. But
yeah, and that's
we would have something to learn.
Right. Yeah, and that's part of the reason why I stressed that, you know, Samuel was grieved over this. We look at it and say, well, you know, let's go with the next king. But this is a very sad story. And you can see some fascination just to looking at, you alluded to this, and this comes up with David, but he sees the mercy that David shows to him. David withholds his hand from judgment and has an impression on him, but it's not the work of the Spirit to convert him, and so it doesn't have, you know, it's not, it doesn't really register in him.
Hebrews 6, that description, he did benefit from what God had been doing in another's life, and he certainly took pleasure in it to some degree, but that's the extent of it, that's the end,
right.
You know, it doesn't take it to the next step, of repentant heart.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I've tried to stress through Judges and also with Saul, that this was, God had his own purpose in making them look forward to the true and promised king. And David, as a type of Christ, then steps in here in the chapters that follow and shows us the true king that God will bring about. However, as in the life of Christ, there is a time of humiliation, and it's a long period of humiliation in David's life. He suffers, although he is king, yet he does not inherit the kingship right away or rule as king right away. So let's just look a little bit at the story of David. Again, we're not quite sure how far we'll get, but in chapter 16, following what we just read, as I said at the beginning, the Lord tells Samuel, asks him, how long will you mourn for Saul? And he's told to go up and anoint one of the sons of Jesse. Now, Jesse, of course, is in the line of David, and this is the promised one from our study in Genesis. The Lord sends Samuel then to the household of Jesse, and David is selected out after going through the older sons of Jesse. David is chosen. But the anointing here is, if it's not private, it's still within the family. He is not publicly declared to be king. The chapter that follows, though, confirms the fact that David is the one who will serve God faithfully. This is the story of Goliath, David and Goliath. Probably the favorite story of most of the boys in the congregation. And an inspiration, I'm sure, of much practice with slingshots and things like that. It has its own theological importance, however. Here is Goliath, this huge man, some 9 feet tall, taunting God's people. And God's people do not respond in faith, apparently. They themselves are dismayed, it says in verse 11 of chapter 17. David is there not as a fighter. He apparently was not old enough to be involved in the battle, or at least he wasn't involved. He was there visiting. And he hears the taunts and volunteers himself to go. So it says in verse 26, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And that that response comes to Saul, and he's David is sent. And I think the passage is familiar enough that I don't need to go about through it. Interestingly enough, in this book, the author points out how the selective use of firepower, even small arms, can be effective in a battle. It applies here, certainly. Goliath did not have complete defense against this kind of firepower. But especially significant is the fact, I think, of what David says in verses 45 and following. This is the man after God's own heart, the king after God's own heart, speaking the word that confirms God's power. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear. The battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." You see the same twofold thrust that we've seen elsewhere. That is, this is a testimony to God's people. And it's an important testimony because, as we've seen, God's people tended to trust in the means that God had appointed. We saw that with sending the ark into battle last week. And it's the same thing here. He wants them to know that God doesn't save with sword and spear. Now, this is a typical Hebrew way of saying it. Of course, God frequently did save by sword and spear. But the point is that it's not the means they should trust in. It's God they should trust in. And whether he saves by sword and spear, or whether, in this case, he did not save by sword and spear, he saved by a appropriately placed stone. And yet the point is, however God saves, the battle is the Lord's, and their trust should be in him, and not in the means that God had appointed. There was a continual temptation to God's people. That was not only a witness to them. In fact, first he says it's going to be a witness to all the earth at the end of verse 46. All the earth may know that there's a God in Israel. And this is the same thing we saw in the Exodus from Egypt and even last week in the Philistine gods falling down and actually losing their own heads, I guess, to the God of Israel when the ark went into their temples. God is triumphing over all the gods of the earth, the false gods, and all the earth is to see from this that there is a God in Israel. That is, he is the true God over all the earth. So, of course, he does prevail and kills and beheads Goliath, they win the battle. Now, from that point on, there's a description of the interaction between Saul and David. David had had some presence before Saul before, but after that especially, he was brought before Saul. And there's this spiral of the jealousy of Saul over the success of David. That jealousy worked itself out in different ways, and ultimately Saul attempts to kill David, and David has to flee. But there is, in the midst of this description, so that's in chapters 18 and 19 especially, is the working through of that up to the attempt to kill David. And David ultimately flees in chapter 21 to Nob and later to Gath, where he acts as a madman. But in between is a beautiful description of the relationship between David and Jonathan. And I think I'll stop by looking briefly at that description in chapter 19. There are in the Bible many minor characters who are worth thinking about. One of my favorites is the Ethiopian who delivered Jeremiah from the cistern. David's interaction with Jonathan here is a good study, and it points to another significant minor character, and that is Jonathan. Look at Jonathan's situation. His father was the king, and he sees in David a reminder that he himself will not be king because of his father's unfaithfulness and rebellion. And yet the reaction of Jonathan is not to hate David, but in chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. He knows what God will do, and he still loves David, and in fact they make a covenant, the two of them together, to serve God. I just read from the beginning of chapter 19, but in chapter 20 that's particularly described. Jonathan arranges for David's escape. There's a longer story, but he gives the information, the inside information from Saul to David. And I'd like to look particularly at this relationship as it's described in verses 12 through 16. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Then, in verse 17, "Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." And it goes on to describe further their conversation there. It's a striking thing that among the enemies that are mentioned in verse 15 is Jonathan's own father. The Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. He realizes that ultimately his own father has to be cut off for David to inherit the throne, and yet he makes this covenant with David and binds them, and they're bound to each other. You remember in the subsequent history, David is faithful to keep that and preserve the son of Jonathan and show him some honor. But this is a beautiful example of how this covenant relationship between two people points to the significance of God's covenant relationship with us, which I've tried to stress as we've surveyed the Old Testament. And that is, the goal is, the covenant is not merely a legal one, although it has legal aspects, but it is God's purpose to draw us to himself, that we would be his people and he would be our God. And the ultimate goal is this bond of love, which is described here. Okay. After this is David hiding in caves and meeting with a fool in Nabal, or more accurately, with the wife of the fool. And so we'll try to pick that up next week. Any comments or questions, though?
We've got another hour to go.
Yeah, apparently, the clocks are not... Well, okay, sure, we can keep going. I've got probably another hour's worth of notes here. Yes, yeah.
I noticed in, you skipped over this, but the when Samuel goes to Bethlehem to anoint David, God tells him to do this. He says, "How can I go? Saul hears that he'll kill me." Then when he goes to Bethlehem, apparently with a heifer in tow, "And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, 'Do you come peaceably?'"
They had a sense that something was up, right?
Well, they obviously had a great deal of respect or fear for this guy. So
yeah.
It's somewhat, I mean, about the sort of dramatic nature.
Yeah, that's right.
He's an old man, with a heifer and toe.
Yeah. It is a good reminder of the authority that he had just as a representative of God, and the way that people realized that.